Welcome to WebRush, the weekly talk show that brings you stories of real-world development from industry experts and developers like you and me. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallin, Craig Shoemaker, and John Papa find out what it takes to write, deploy, and maintain apps that stand up to the demands of the real world. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome back to WebRush, the podcast where we all get a rush from using the web. And today we're going to be talking about surviving technical debt, which, oh boy, that's something that I've had to deal with a lot throughout my career in technology. And I'll bet you my co-hosts today have as well. Welcome Ward and Dan back to the show. And man, have you all dealt with tech debt a lot?
Just other people's.
Yeah. I just delete the app. I mean, it's a pretty easy problem to solve.
So Ward, does that mean that you never create tech debt?
Never. Look, you know, when you've been around as long as I have, you don't create debt anymore.
That's just a great proposition. We should all hire Ward and his company to code
for us. That's my commercial. We leave no technical debt.
Is that because you write no code?
That's exactly it. The name of my company is Lazy Pros, and our motto is "Got nothing to do? Let us help."
Oh my, it's going to be one of those days, everybody out there. I hope you're still with us listening to this podcast 60 seconds in. And today we have a great friend of the show and of all three of us on here, Mike Ryan. How you doing, Mike?
I'm well. How are you?
We're pretty good. And for those of you out there who may or may not be familiar with Mike, let me tell you a little bit more about him. Mike's a software architect at Synapse, tackling sustainability in manufacturing. He's a Google development expert, a GDE, the co-creator of NGRX. We'll have to ask you what that is. And it's an open source. Oh, you're telling me it's an open source organization that builds high quality reactive libraries for Angular. Welcome, Mike, to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So just quickly, you manage and support NGRX, this large open source project that's been around for years. Just give us a quick, what is it and what's it like being somebody who's involved in producing software that runs people's businesses?
Sure. So like you mentioned, NGRX is just a collection of libraries that try to help developers build Angular applications with reactive programming. It sort of supercharges your reactivity in your Angular apps, lets you build more and more with RxJS. It was started a couple of years ago, I want to say 2016, with really a focus on state management and bringing Redux-like state management patterns to Angular developers, but again, supercharged with RxJS. And so since then, it has grown and evolved. We still really focus on state management. That's a big piece of our collection of libraries, but we also have libraries now that help you integrate with your APIs, whether we're talking about NGRX data or NGRX components for bringing reactivity into your Angular components. So there's a lot of real breadth of reactivity now in that organization.
And today, I appreciate you giving us that clarity. And today we're actually not talking about the library, but how to survive technical debt. And I raised the library because you can't support and build a library like that without, I imagine, incurring some technical debt along the way.
For sure. And technical debt in a library like that is challenging to try and address because, as you mentioned, businesses run on NGRX. Developers rely on the code that we ship as part of those libraries. And one man's tech debt could be behavior that another application is depending on. And so it can be really challenging to try and navigate how you might address that technical debt and how you might evolve a library over time.
Now, Mike, unlike a lot of library developers, you actually use this thing within your company at Synapse, right?
That's right.
And you've been with Synapse for how long?
Almost 5 years. I joined them back in, again, I want to say 2016, early 2016, to help them begin the migration from AngularJS to Angular, and along the way help them implement NGRX. So not only have I contributed a lot and helped design and create the NGRX organization, but I have been a dedicated consumer of those libraries along the way.
And so you've been, over 5 years, you must have done a pretty good job of adding technical debt to the application.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. To me, technical debt is just you discovered requirements after you started writing code, and now you have to cope with it later. And that means, you know, we're all going to do some requirement discovery in our time, and the code we write is not going to quite handle that, or it's not going to be sustainable the way we need it to be. And I have written tons and tons of code like that.
Yeah, I do find it convenient to blame the customer for a lot of this technical debt.
That's exactly what I'm doing. It's the customer's fault that I wrote that code poorly.
Yeah, I exactly. I mean, they keep changing it, and you have to change it with you, and a little bit of the old stuff gets left behind, and they keep giving you deadlines. You got to get it done, and so...
And expectations, too. Not just deadlines, but expectations.
Yeah, what's up with that, Mike?
Well, I know. So, if only we didn't have users, and people who had to pay us.
You know, one of the biggest things that I've always struggled with, and I think we must have talked about this at some point on the show, amongst other topics, but it's a good day to kind of go this road, is version control. You know, when you put out code, one of the things that always goes to technical debt is how do you manage the versions which you put out? And let's say you put out a library or a piece of code that is version 1.0.0. And we probably should talk about what that even means too, but... And then you all of a sudden realize there's a problem with something in the code that you need to refactor an interface and the way people call it. So what do you do? Do you break the people that are there? Do you, try to backwards compatibly smush it together? I mean, am I giving you enough, Mike, to kind of see, like, how do you tackle these things?
Yeah, that's something that comes up in NGRX. Obviously, the best way is to not break users ever. You know, if success or the ideal of success is anything for an open source library author is to not break users. But like you said, if that tech debt really stems from a public part of the interface, it can be really challenging to try and address that in a way that doesn't break them. So in NGRX, the approach we've always taken with that is to first communicate as much as possible to users that this interface is going to change. Give them time to move away from the interface to a new interface. And what that usually means is introducing the new interface that's going to replace it in one release, letting that gestate live for a couple of months, up to a year, maybe even more, so that developers have time to move that new interface and then remove that old one. If the tech debt's in the public interface, it gets really tricky.
I think that's a good approach because there's something I'm on right now that we're already hitting that problem, and it's a new project. So if you were to, cause there's two angles I see to this, there's new projects and trying to manage for tech debt, right? And then there's existing projects, which gets into the version control and just dealing with older tech debt. So tackling it first from a new, like if you were starting a brand new project, are there any strategies out of the box? Because you're not going to avoid it, but there are certainly strategies you can plan for to help maybe minimize, we'll call it the really bad debt. Is there anything you would recommend to people that are starting like a greenfield type project?
Yes. Design up front as much as possible and include your users in that design process.
I have to interrupt you. Did you just say use waterfall?
I know. I'm hearing there's even an acronym for this.
And I'm being a little facetious, right? Obviously, because I know that's not exactly what you mean, but can you clarify a little?
Yeah, for sure. I'll talk about how we do it at NGRX and then also how I do it inside of Synapse. Because I think NGRX maybe does look a little like that waterfall approach, but day to day, I work on agile teams and that doesn't quite work for us. But for NGRX, the open source library, the way to do it is we have to be very, very careful. And so we have a public design document template that pretty much every new feature or break and change must fill out to describe exactly what the design is of the new functionality, how it's going to break existing users, what that migration path looks like, how the documentation needs to be changed as a result of that. And so it's up to the person who wants to enact the change to fill out this template. And then they have to publish it in an open issue on a repository and give our users enough time to read through the design documents, to make suggestions, to make changes. And so it creates a really good relationship, I think, between us and our community of users, because it's up to us to make sure we understand how our users are using those public interfaces before we go ahead and try and change it. And it also gives the community members some time to say, hey, look, this either will not or won't or will work for my application, and give us that feedback early. And so that's really critical to NGRX, but that takes a long time. we've been told by people who have tried to contribute to NGRX that things move slowly. In fact, we've had maintainers say, okay, I really wish I could contribute to NGRX, but I need to go work on my own library or at my own pace because this is just too slow and too deliberate for me. And you have to be when you reach that scale, when you have that many developers relying on you and so many big projects, you have to kind of have that care. At Synapse, it's a little bit different. We are usually our own consumers of code, and so we can move a little bit more quickly, but we still go through what we call design sprints at the beginning of work, and that's usually a 3 to 5 day activity where we really try to unpack a set of requirements, design software to it, iterate, and prototype as quickly as possible before we move into actual implementation. So there's still that spirit of designing up front, but it's a little more quick, a little more accelerated in that day-to-day setting.
Well, thanks for the details on there, Mike, because I'm kind of wondering about...
Now, wait a minute. As long as you're wondering,
yeah.
I think you should be wondering about our sponsor. So here's a word from our sponsor.
So, John, one of the things I like about AG Grid, which is a data grid component for the kind of complex grid scenarios that we encounter all the time in enterprise apps, one of the things I really like about it is that it works for a variety of frameworks, Angular, React, Vue, or just vanilla JS. Does that ring a bell for you?
Oh, it really does. There's all these different companies that I work with where they have no choice but to use a lot of these different tools because they have different teams working on them. So being able to port their code or share that code and that technical investment they have is really important to them.
Yeah, well, it's important to us. Ideally, we're a consulting company, and you know, we never know what our client's going to want to use, Angular, React, or Vue, but they're all going to need a grid, and it's great to be able to reach for the one grid that works everywhere, AG Grid.
You know, at any size company, too, because you could have these teams that maybe they only use one framework, but eventually they're going to switch to another one and be able to take that investment again and use it, reuse it is really nice.
So if a multi-framework data grid makes sense to you, please go check out AG Grid at ag-grid.com.
And we're back. And Dan was wondering something.
I was, but it was a good commercial break, you know. So Mike, kind of the reason I wanted to ask about the first, because there's two angles there. There's new projects, you know, the greenfield stuff, and then you have the stuff that's been around for a long time. And you actually answer how I hoped you would, because a lot of people do say, oh, no, we don't need to plan. We're going to be so agile that we're just going to jump in. And having been on some of those projects over the years with companies, that ends up being a nightmare when you don't spend, like you said, you take, you know, 3 to 5 days maybe to just unpack. It might just be one feature, right? I'm not talking about the whole app. But I guess my point is that, yes, there is still some planning, some architecture involved, because otherwise you're absolutely going to have technical debt, right?
For sure. And that design process not only helps you make sure you have sort of the right structure or interfaces in place to avoid tech debt, it also has this other element to it where if you include the implementing team in that design process, it's been my experience that they come away with a much better understanding of the architecture if they felt included in that upfront design. And engineers who understand the architecture tend to write code that better adheres to that architecture over the course of the project. And that is another just, you know, general strategy for avoiding tech debt or accumulating tech debt across that implementation process. Yes, design up front, whether it's existing or new.
It's a myth, actually, that Agile says don't plan. It's one of the misunderstandings about Agile and Fowler and a whole bunch of other people have gone into how that was misunderstood. What you're not supposed to do is detail everything out. You're supposed to find the things that need planning and separate those from the kinds of things that have low risk if you just let them evolve as necessary. So just in case anybody was wondering about that.
Yeah, for sure. To us, we can't know everything before we start a project, right? There's the old rule that you only know 40 to 70%, and we try to aim for some percentage of understanding up front. But if we can eliminate those easy risks up front in the design process instead of letting them materialize during implementation, I mean, that's just a more successful project for us. And we can do that in an agile way. And that is part of our agile process.
So. Mike, I love agile. I really do. And I agree with what your points were. Like you can't, there's a lot of myths about it out there, but I want to switch topics a little bit on specific types of technical debt that I'm sure folks out here have encountered.
such as that. We talked about version control, for example, and how you manage these things. But there's also that, let me give you a scenario. You walk into a project and your boss tells you, we want to add these features to it at your company. And usually it's, we want to add it, you know, in 2 weeks, and, you know, the scope is like, you know, 9 months of the work, and you're looking at how you're going to pull all this off. And one of the first things that happens is there's always more to do than there is time. And you have to get up to speed in the project and figure out how to insert these features. Now, the project was written in a framework or technology that is a couple of versions old at this point. You've since learned, even if it was by yourself, you've since learned new ways to do things. And the new ways don't really plug into the old ways. How do you decide if you should figure out how to insert the code at this point using that older style, or basically just throw it aside and start fresh? Or like, how do you go through that process when you're, because you deal with this a lot?
For sure. So to me, it's always like, is tech debt worth addressing? And you're kind of hitting on it from a development velocity perspective. Addressing tech debt might increase that velocity. To me, I'd want to evaluate it based on the divergence of the new pattern versus the old pattern, because sometimes a pattern can be bad, but if it's familiar to a development team, that might be the fastest pattern for them to implement with. And so if I'm looking at the new pattern or a new strategy to write that code, I'd want to understand, okay, how much do I think this will improve velocity after my developers get up to speed on that new pattern? And also, how long is it going to take for me to get those developers up to speed on that pattern? Those are, you know, there's two bits to that cycle there, because they're going to be slow starting that new pattern no matter what. They don't understand it. They haven't learned it perhaps. And so I really want to try and quantify that. How long is it going to take them to get up to speed? And once they're up to speed, how much is it going to increase overall throughput? And I think once you have those two numbers, it's easy to go back to the stakeholders and make an argument one way or the other as to whether the tech debt should be addressed or not.
And how do you ignore tech debt? Like, let's say you make the decision, I see something that just looks like it's awful and it's bothering the heck out of me, but I've decided through business and development of velocity timeframes, I can't address this. How do you do that?
Like emotionally, I go outside and I scream. But day to day, you know, it's just a matter of, like you said, there could be real technical or business reasons why you want to ignore it. And in those situations, it's best to try and kind of do what I would consider to be quarantine. Quarantine the code as best as you can, write tests around it where you find time to write tests around it, and live with those repercussions for as long as you're able to do so.
So I have to add in one personal relatable story here. I've worked on a few projects with Ward, and Ward doesn't let me live with technical debt for more than 0.2 seconds. As I'm typing the error in my code, he's yelling at me to correct the code.
Oh, what are you doing?
Oh,
you
know,
living with technical debt for like, you know, a week, that would be fantastic for me.
All right. So here, I was going to turn this around, John. I'm going to sing the praises of technical debt. I even think that the word debt, you know, we've overstretched the analogy. And I think this is really where you're going, Mike, is that there's a tendency, you know, that seems to be some way we give permission to ourselves to fuss over the code when there's no business reason to make a change. And the bad thing about the word debt, the problem with that word is that it sounds like, oh, you got to keep paying, you know, you have to pay interest on the debt all the time. And it's not true. There's lots of vast reaches of code in that I've seen written, never written myself, of course, but seen written that I they're not great, but it would be injurious to the project to address, and they're not hurting anything. It's when the time to retire what we call technical debt is when it gets in the way of someplace you need to go.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I'm sure you feel that way too.
For sure. Yeah. Like you said, the word debt implies you have to pay it one day and you don't. And, you know, there are reasons why you might want to. I think improving developer velocity, like you mentioned, John, is one of those reasons, but also it could be for product reasons. If we're creating a slow experience for our users or the app is crashing a lot, or it could be things like our ability to hire new engineers to work on the project. You know, you have to look at the engineers you can hire, and is the architecture of the code you have right now something that you can sustain with new developers? So there's a lot of reasons why you might want to pay it, but if none of those reasons exist, it might not make financial sense or business sense to go address it.
Are you saying, Mike, that you shouldn't and our listeners shouldn't re-architect an entire app the night before it goes live just because they read an article by Dan Wallin that says, here's a new cool technology you should use.
Well, if Dan wrote it, then sure, but not if Ward wrote it.
There you go. Now we're aligned.
Well, I talk to Ward, so everything you're hearing from me is really just, I'm just like a ghostwriter, you know, Ward. But
so when I look at some code, I'm sure you guys, you're like this too, Mike. You look at any, you're working on something and you stumble into something. Do you address, what kinds of things do you address right away? And what kinds of things do you just hold, you know, hand over your eyes and keep going? I have my list of things I do. I have some like really easy things that I like to do, but I'm kind of curious when do you indulge this need for sort of debt retirement without strong justification?
Without the strong justification, there are some things that are to me just like easy wins, like turning on auto code formatter, you know, if formatting is a problem with the code base, you know, just, you can do that easily and no one's going to mind, just kind of move on with that. Tests, like just unit tests in general, to me drive me crazy if there's not tests around something. I will write tests for code if the tests are missing. I don't need to ask for permission to do that. I will do that because it will drive me crazy. So sort of those general, like, can I at least change the code and modify it and feel good about it and not get hung up on formatting, or is the code still working afterwards?
Well, I was just going to throw in three things that I routinely do. One of them is I delete commented out code.
Oh, that's a great one.
You know, with as long as we have source control, hey, you really don't need that stuff. And there are vast reaches of that stuff. So that's number one for me. I see deleted out code, I kick it to the curb right away. A second thing I do is if I'm reading code and I suddenly realize that the variables or the function names, the names have nothing to do with what they are actually are. Like maybe it's X or maybe it's just completely wrong. I refactor names constantly to sort of improve readability. So I'll do that. And then the third is, if there is something and I'm reading it and it took me a long time to understand what it is, but eventually understand that it actually makes sense, even though, I mean, you know, you can see it adds one to X, all right? I don't need a comment that says add one to X, but if there's some way I can tell the next poor reader who comes along why we're adding one to X if it's not obvious, then I think adding a comment is actually a way to lower the debt, improving it for the next time somebody comes along. So those are my three easy debt reduction ideas. Now, maybe Dan and John, you have some of your favorites.
I actually love those. And I want to jump on your number three and plus one and expand it. Adding a comment, why? Not just adding a comment, but adding a comment, why something is there. And one of the techniques that I like to do a lot is, and Warren, you and I have done a lot of pairing on this, we'll read code, we'll both struggle to figure out what it is, and then our first step is once we figure it out, we comment it, but that doesn't stop there. So we comment why this thing works the way it does and a little bit of how, but mostly why. And then we'll actually try to take the next step after committing to re-architect the function or the code to be clearer so that the comments weren't even necessary in the first place. Because sometimes the code is just convoluted. And it's doing nine things. And yeah, adding the comment explaining why is great, but maybe the code could actually have been rewritten. For example, you're returning some HTTP call. You make an HTTP call, you get some data back. It's customer data. And the name of the variable you're sticking it in is called response. And then you take that and you munge it and you transform it into a variable called data. And then, you know, eight more lines down the code, you've forgotten what you got. And now you've got things saying, take the response, look at the data. And now you're like, what the heck is, you know, it's like overly generic code. So I find this a lot. And so to me, the steps are figure it out, comment why, and then try to refactor if you can. And if you can't, the comments stick around. Or if you can, you delete the comments. Dan, what do you do?
No, I totally agree. I'm probably guilty of adding too many comments, I would say, but they're not comments like getting customers, you know, when the function is...
For a function called get customers.
Right. Right. I mean,
or how about the end if? Do you comment the end if to tell people where the end of the if statement is?
No. I totally agree, though, with what Ward started and what you just chimed in, John. And Mike, I'm sure you probably do this as well, where you know you have those scenarios where, first off, you know you may not remember why. But second off, when there's multiple team members involved, and this is the case usually when I've worked with these bigger enterprise teams, where it gets pretty confusing on why, because you've all probably seen the joke online where if you try to refactor this, you know, please increment it by one and then say that it didn't work. You know, who knows if that's real or not, but I could see it being real. So, but to pivot a little bit, Mike, how much, one thing I've seen with technical debt that comes up a lot is what I call the what if scenarios. And this is where you're sitting down with the customer, like you said, maybe you're doing that 3 to 5 day unpack type event, sitting down, and the, well, what if Ward wants this down the road? And then somebody else is like, yeah, and if we do that, what if John, you know, I could see him wanting this. And I would love, I always joke about this, I would love to see a study. I don't know if there is one. If anyone knows of one, let me know. But that actually analyzes the what if, and I would be willing to bet it is a very minuscule percentage that that actually came into the app, that scenario. Have you, and to wrap my question up here for you, because there is a question here, that leads to like unnecessary interfaces, unnecessary types, unnecessary, you know, all kinds of stuff. And have you run into that much where we kind of over-architect, I guess you could say?
Tons and tons. As a software architect, that's kind of one of the areas where I try and help the software teams at Synapse excel is, avoid hasty abstractions. And just this idea of, yeah, there's lots of different ways we can see the product maturing, but the simplest interface maintained is the smallest interface. And that's one that addresses the requirements that are concrete and in front of you. And that is such a guiding principle for me in terms of how we architect, is really trying to keep the interfaces and the abstractions as small as possible that match the upfront requirements, knowing that it's easier to pivot those small abstractions to something else as we, you know, actually pursue different features down the road than it is to try and design something complex up front and pivot that when we realize that those hasty abstractions didn't quite cover the reality we thought we would eventually come to. It gets tricky though for projects like NGRX, where you are about to put an interface into the world that you're going to have to live with for a decade. You know, that's where it becomes, that's where reality hits you and you're like, well, maybe I do need to think a little more down the road if I am going to try and keep this interface around forever. And so, you know, when it comes to like public APIs, that's where that aha sentiment starts to unravel a little bit. But generally, avoiding hasty abstractions is the way I like to architect.
They have a lot of good songs too, just so you know, aha architecture team.
Take on me, Dan. Let's go.
Take on me. And always shines on TV.
So I've got a special take for y'all today. But before we get to that, let's take a break from a word from our sponsors.
Hey, are you building apps in React, Angular, Node, or some other framework? Well, with NX, you can build your full stack apps in a shared mono repo, integrate with modern tools, and reinforce best practices. You'll get advanced code generation and automatically configured tooling like Cypress, Jest, and Prettier that will simplify your workflow. NX also helps you simplify the relationships between applications and shared libraries to make it easier to share more code and develop more consistently across teams. And the best part is, you'll build higher quality apps and spend less time on configuration. So visit nx.dev to get Narwhal's popular open source toolkit for monorepo development today.
And we're back, and here's a take from Special Ward.
All right. So we talked about opportunistic debt reduction and, you know, earlier, but
those are big words.
Opportunistic. Yes. And in that category is anything that you can kind of slide in there without making gigantic changes, and you don't have to get permission and all that. You don't have to have a big business need, but really when it comes down to it is when you look at it and you say, I'm in trouble. That whatever I've run into here in the code is, this is big trouble and I've got to do something about it. So now, Mike, I'm curious, do you just chip away at it, or do you just say, screw it, we got to rewrite the whole thing? What's your take on that spectrum?
you know, that's one where I think that's kind of getting to the technical details of what is, you know, what are your capabilities? At Synapse, we've encountered two really big boulders we had to move in terms of tech debt. One was the migration from AngularJS to Angular, and there was a corresponding one that was similar, which was going from Python 2 to Python 3. These are probably big transitions that folks might relate to. With AngularJS to Angular, from a capabilities perspective, we looked at it and we knew we had the ability to run AngularJS code and Angular code side by side, run them in parallel, ship the same app. There's lots of strategies to do this, each with their own trade-offs, but generally there was a strategy that worked for us. And so that situation, we made the decision that, okay, given that we can run these code bases side by side, let's incrementally over time move code from that AngularJS code base to Angular code base. That's a process that's taken us years. We're still not finished. We actually are going to finish in 2021, which I'm excited about. It looks like we're actually going to wrap it up. But, you know, it was a conscious choice that this will take us years to get there, but we can do it, and we're comfortable with what that entails. The Python 2 to Python 3 migration, on the other hand, for us, was a little different in that the Python code was running on an appliance. It was an embedded device, and there just wasn't the performance overhead to run both code bases at the same time. And so we didn't really have, from a technical perspective, the ability to incrementally go from one to the other. And so what that caused was we had to stop as an engineering organization, pause for 1 to 2 quarters, and sort of big bang refactor from Python 2 to Python 3, because we didn't really have another choice if we wanted to make that leap. And so, you know, it can get really tricky. You really have to look at it from a technical perspective, but also if you do go down that big bang approach, that's something that product management and your stakeholders are comfortable with. And so, yeah. It gets tricky.
You generally try and avoid big bang though, right?
Generally, I would always prefer an incremental strategy where we can do it bit by bit, because it's easy to sort of tuck away migrations or refactors where, hey, I found a little bit of available bandwidth across the teams, or here's a really good opportunity where we can deliver a new feature and remove some tech debt at the same time. And so those incremental approaches are by far my preferred approach. But I also know developers can get frustrated with, hey, this has taken us a long time to get there.
You know, I'm running into one of those with my current client. This will resonate for people because it's not just big technology switches. Sometimes, for example, with legacy applications, they had a pattern that they used, like putting everything in stored procedures. And now I remember coming up, man, that was it. Like, if it's not in a stored procedure, you're doing it wrong. And now the advice is exactly the opposite.
I used to do that, Ward. I have to admit, that was a long time ago.
But I think he's referring to your code, Dan, actually.
He probably was.
Well, oh gosh. So, you know, you don't have to be making a move from Python, one version of Python or one version of Angular to another. You can encounter this stuff in any legacy, any application that's been around for 5 to 10 years. It was going to be built upon patterns that were the shizzle at one time. And now we know not to use a word like the shizzle. That's an old, the whole pattern is changed, and the whole, all the advice, what was good is bad, that kind of thing. So anyway, that's one. Stored procedures is one that I've run into. John and Dan, can you think of some things where the advice about how to construct something has changed and now you have to decide how that should ripple through your app?
Yeah. One would be, we used to really promote kind of an end tier or end layer application. And then the problem became, due to shifting things more front end or whatever, there's more communication to these back ends than needed to be, because now you had middleware server and you had web server and you had, so that would be one that used to be really prevalent. And then last one is, the big thing you hear a lot about today is microservices and micro front ends. And I'm already seeing pushback from some really big names out there on who were totally on the microservice, for instance, bandwagon. And now they're like, no, I was wrong.
Microservices wrong, is the new tech debt. Let's hear it. Woo!
And I'm not going to go out on the branch and say it's wrong, though, Ward, because I'm wrong, but I'm a keep a simple guy. So anyway, that's a few I've seen.
Yeah, I like those. And the one that I've seen most proliferated, if I could say that word correctly. I'm trying to use big words like Word today. So instead of saying I've seen it a lot, I'm going to say it's proliferation of this technique. And that's, for a long time, people were designing websites, me included, where we didn't have these client-side web frameworks. We designed websites to use like ASP.NET or PHP or stuff that was server-side generated. And what happens is that with that pattern, every time you do something on the page, you're making a post back to the server and you come back to the client. So how do you maintain your state? It's very common to send state back to the server and put it into like a database, like Couchbase or something. So then now migrate to, a lot of people are using client-side web frameworks these days where you don't need to do that kind of thing. And they're still maintaining state in a database, even though they don't have to be. So this is one of those things I think has changed. It's not that it was a bad pattern. It's that things moved forward and some of the things we used to do aren't nearly as useful as they used to be in a lot of cases.
Does this resonate, Mike? Do you see because you're at Synapse, you've seen the application itself over time. It must have accumulated some inflection points like that.
Oh, for sure. And the microservices one really resonated with me. I mean, it's been such you know, like the dominant architecture when we're talking about building scalable cloud services. And we happened to build one of those at Synapse. And that was one of our natural inclinations at first was, oh, we should just go ahead and break everything up. Lambda functions for everything, microservices, little bits of code everywhere. And yeah, it doesn't take a lot of effort to realize that what you're doing is you're creating a lot of interfaces. And one of the things we talked about earlier was that tech debt and interfaces is one of the hardest things to try and fix because it typically has impacts both for your code and the consumer. And those microservices produce a lot of that kind of tech debt. And thankfully, we managed to avoid that pitfall. We started with a monolith, one big old server running all of our code, one application, one node process. And then we refactored as we hit scalability issues.
Mike, one thing I want to make sure we touch on before we wrap up is a lot of what we're talking about, I think, and tell me if you disagree, are lessons you and others have learned through years of experience of going through identifying technical debt. So you know, you just kind of know at this point where that line is of when you should do things. What advice do you have for folks who maybe haven't gone through that yet, or perhaps earlier in their career, or haven't had the opportunity to do so, that you could lend on them that you wish future Mike could tell past Mike?
Yeah. And it kind of gets back to that phrase tech debt and what Ward mentioned earlier. Not only does tech debt make you feel like you have to pay it off, but it also makes you not want to incur it. And I would encourage junior Mike that it is okay to incur tech debt. It is more valuable to ship code to customers and put functionality in their hands than it is to avoid tech debt. And I wish junior Mike had understood that that was okay to do. And that's what I would offer to junior developers.
Really good advice. I have nothing to add to that. Hey, Mike, we like to end our show with a final thought for our listeners that is out there. And this could be on topic, what we're talking about today, or it could be just something really relevant in your life that you want to share with folks out there. And I'll kick things off with my final thought for folks is there's different forms of technical debt. And one thing I really like about our modern technology is that we've got tools that help us avoid it in some cases. For example, a tool that Mike raised is the Angular CLI. The Angular CLI, like the Vue CLI, for a matter of fact, has a feature called ng update, ng for Angular, and update. And what that update will do is you apply that to, let's say, the previous version of Angular app, and will actually in place try to update your code to take away things that are no longer needed or modify it for the current version. Now, you could argue maybe that's not tech debt as much as migration, but one of the ways we incur tech debt is by losing track of versions over time. So I really love that we have tooling these days that can help you with that. And my advice to everybody is definitely invest time looking at those. And one lesson I learned is always commit your changes before you start that process, so you can see exactly what's happening.
Well, I've done that.
Dan, what's your final thought for our audience?
Commit your changes before you start that. That's my final thought, Ward. You said that and I'm just like, oh my gosh, I have some stories there. Well, I would say from a technical side, a more serious side, the keep a simple approach has always worked extremely well for me. There are apps that get complex. That's just a given. But I think if you start with the goal of, hey, let's keep this so that junior, you know, mid-tier and senior people can work on it, that you're going to be good to go. On a more fun note, I got a text from my wife this morning to this link on target.com about this baby Grogu, baby Yoda doll. And she's like, oh, I got to get this. She loves the Mandalorian and baby Yoda, which is kind of funny. And Ward, to end this story, I'll make sure you get one of these too.
Great, because I don't know what you're talking about.
It's Star Wars. You love Star Wars.
Oh, that's it. And it always comes back to Star Wars.
So I'll put a link in the chat here, but Hasbro came out with this baby Yoda Grogu doll that is like amazing on the motions. And it's like, it was like $59. I think I lucked out. She said it and I literally ran straight to the store because I knew it would go. And then I looked online later. I'm like, you know, if I was one of those people that buy stuff like scalpers and then marks it up, there was three of them. I'm not one of those people though. So anyway, it's pretty funny. So check out the Hasbro Baby Yoda doll if you're into The Mandalorian at all. It's pretty amazing. Yeah, Ward, I know now you're speechless. You're just like, I don't have anything to add to that.
Well, but I have indulged in similar kinds of things. I have a Fembot in my garage that I've wrapped in saran wrap. In a time console. For those of you who don't know, Fembot was something that occurred in the Austin Powers. So you know, I can't.
All right, we're going to need a link in the show notes on this one, Ward. You lost.
So I have one. Well, go look up Fembot. Anyway, I got one. And it's in the garage, folks. Anyway, the on-topic thing, tip I have is avoid code generators, because those are tech debt generators. You know, it's the automated way to create a lot of tech debt is just fire off of a code generation and have it kick out a whole bunch of code for you. That's my tip. Do not do that. Younger self.
Ward, I don't know if you remember this, but many years ago, he once told me that code that is generated is code that a human has to maintain later. And that has always stuck with me.
That's a good quote.
And so will that code. Mike, what is your final thought for our audience?
Yeah, so we've talked about avoid hasty abstractions, keep it simple, and that also has an impact to your library choices. So like I mentioned, I'm one of the co-creators of NGRX, but I see many developers prematurely pick libraries like NGRX because it is what a lot of people are doing and it didn't quite fit their needs or their use cases. And so when you're doing library selection, keep it simple. Pick the simple libraries out and keep it basic.
You know, one of the things I want to call out here, Mike, and I don't usually have a final thought after all these, but I think it warrants it for today, is that I have a lot of respect for you. And I say that because you're one of the first people I've seen. I'm sure others have probably done this, but you're one of the first people I've seen who's written a library and then gone up on stage at multiple conferences and had a talk titled, Why You Shouldn't Use My Library. And I just, tons of respect go out to you for that, because you have reasons. There are reasons not to use something. And it's good. And it seems almost silly sometimes, because you're like, wait a minute, didn't you create that? Why wouldn't you want me to use it? But I think it just shows a lot of experience and maturity and a lot of selflessness. So I kudos to you, my friend.
I was going to say real quick, John, the final on your final is, I totally agree. It shows a ton of experience in the field. And Mike, I also have had a lot of respect for that, because you know, a lot of people get locked into, well, I created this, you should use it. And is the right tool for the right job. So,
yeah, you know, I'm a software architect at heart, and I built NGRX because it solved a problem I had, and I'm thrilled that it solves problems for other people's too. But I also know when it's not going to work, and I've built libraries that have not used it or projects that have not used it. And so, yeah, I just feel like it's a responsibility to give that kind of guidance along with the code.
Hey, Mike, thanks for coming on again today. We really enjoyed this conversation, and we'd love to invite you back sometime to talk more about other topics as well, if you're up for it.
I'd love to come back. Thanks, John.
And thank you all for listening to yet another episode of Web Rush, the podcast, and you'll hear from us every week.